We'll start in just a minute. We're waiting for a few more people to finish their yogi job or something like that. How's the sound? Can you hear me okay? Okay, thank you. Not quite sure how we're going to know when everybody's here. We'll just give it another minute or two. Yeah, I'll speak up. Got it, thanks. Not starting quite yet. So let's just sit for about 2 minutes and then we'll begin the talk. Start. So tonight, thought I'd talk a little bit about right effort, kind of a traditional teaching, part of the Noble Eightfold Path. before that, I think I'll read a quick passage from the Dhammapada. You might have heard of the Dhammapada. It's an early Buddhist text, kind of poetic. It says, let go of the past. Let go of the future. Let go of the present and cross over to the farther shore of existence. With mind wholly liberated, you shall come no more to birth and death. So I find that a very inspiring passage. It may or may not land up a little higher. Yeah. I don't know if I should move this up. Is that louder? Okay. So we were talking earlier today about what is enlightenment, and that passage is kind of a pointing. But I guess the real point is it's hard to define. And many teachers from many different traditions have tried to, you know, they've put their own spin on it. But at the end of the day, it's sort of something to be experienced, not explained. So we can't fully, give a perfect definition necessarily. But I've always liked that, let go of the past, okay, fine. Let go of the future, okay, sure. Let go of the present. Wait a minute, what? and cross over to the farther shore. So maybe we'll return to that later in the talk, but I wanted to read something from a book called One Dharma by Joseph Goldstein that I've always found helpful. He says, and of course the big word that is often used for this experience of enlightenment is nibbana or nirvana. And of course that word, as Joseph says here, he's eaten at restaurants named Nirvana. Some of us have, maybe we didn't see him live, but we've listened to the band Nirvana, things like that. So that it's a popular word in our language these days, but in the Pali is Nibbana with two B's in the middle, but it means the same thing. So Joseph says, in India, the term Nibbana also has a popular usage, although it is somewhat more aligned with its actual meaning. In this chapter, he says Nirvana and Nibbana are used interchangeably. Ajahn Buddhadasa, a well-known Thai master of the last century, said that when village people in India were cooking rice and waiting for it to cool, they might remark, "Wait a little for the rice to become Nibbana." Cool. So here, Nibbana means the cool state of mind, free from the fires of the defilements. As Ajahn Buddhadasa remarked, the cooler the mind, the more Nibbana in that moment. We can notice for ourselves relative states of coolness in our own minds as we go through the day. Notice the difference between being caught up in a desire and the moment when the wanting comes to an end. Can you experience the coolness, the relief of being out of the grip of some craving, even when the desire was pleasurable? Or when there's pain in the body, notice the difference when there's some level of contraction through fear and aversion, and when there's an openness of heart through courage and awareness. These examples point to the qualities of Nibbana: relief, release, peace. And Ajahn Buddhadasa famously talked about sort of little nibbanas, how you could have these little moments, kind of like he just described, of some sense of this type of peace. And I think he even said something like that if we didn't have these, we'd kind of go nuts. That we need, things ebb and flow. We need that experience. This is why I don't like using the computer. let's see. So, in terms of, here we are in our last night of the retreat, and hopefully you had some small moments of Nibbana, coolness, peace. we talked a lot about establishing awareness and being present and things like that. And then one could wonder, why do we need to do that? What is the aim here? We just talked about nibbana, a little, this coolness from the defilements, the greed, aversion, delusion that can, you know, come up and sort of taint our experience. And one story that pointed a lot of this out to me was I had gone to Burma, Myanmar, to practice with Sayadaw Utejaniya. And, you know, he's really all about continuous awareness. And one interesting thing was there were these bumper stickers that were all over the monastery that said, "Be mindful," in English and Burmese. And I wasn't expecting that at the monastery. I thought you know, maybe go home and put that on your refrigerator or something. But so everywhere you went in the monastery, you'd see these stickers, "Be mindful." But it turns out we need a lot of reminders, apparently, because I've had a wonderful time practicing at the monastery, and then it started to be near the end of my time there, and Sayadaw had a way of kind of coming and going from the monastery unexpectedly, so he didn't always know when he was going to be there. He would just kind of go off for 3 days without warning. And one of the highlights of being there was having meetings with him. And there were sort of, I was in the English speaking group or whatever to meet with him. And we'd had one meeting 1 week, and then we were supposed to have another meeting, and he went away for 3 days. And then he came back, and we thought, well, surely we'll get another meeting with him, and then he left again. And so then I was realizing, well, I'm going to have to leave, and he's gone again. And I'm not going to get to have another meeting with him. And, you know, we do this thing where we start feeling sorry for ourselves or whatever. Like, I came all this way and I only got like one or two meetings. So I realized, and I went back to the room that I was staying in. And I realized I was pretty agitated about this. And I didn't really know what to do. And I kind of sat down on my bed and I saw the sticker "Be mindful" on the door, the back of the door. And I thought, oh yeah, I'm supposed to be mindful. And I'm not just supposed to be walking around upset that I can't meet with the teacher. What kind of a practitioner am I anyway? But, you know, these kind of things go in our head. But what I realized was I wanted to be mindful of pleasant things. I didn't want to be mindful of unpleasant things. And I realized, oh, I need to be mindful not only of, you know, the nice cool breeze under the shade or whatever, walking around the monastery, but also this agitated state I was in. So I just sat on the bed and kind of meditated and sat with it and saw kind of where it was coming from and then worked through it and kind of had, you know, bring in wisdom. What an idea. But the practice gives us this ability to bring in wisdom and not just be caught in the agitation. And so I kind of went through and I thought, well, even if I don't see Sayadaw again, you know, I'll see him again someday on another retreat. And it's been an amazing visit at this monastery, and the meetings I already had with him were wonderful. And I couldn't really ask for much more if I'm really thinking about it clearly. And so after a few minutes, I felt good again. I talked about, you know, doing a short gratitude practice. In a way, that's what I did. I kind of assessed all the positive things rather than focusing on the one thing that didn't seem to be going my way. So then I kind of had calmed down and just felt like, okay, I feel good again. And then I went back outside, and here comes Sayadaw returning to the monastery. With a big, you know, bunch of people walking with him. And then one of the other people from the English-speaking group was just like standing there waiting for him practically and immediately accosted him and said, "Sayadaw, we have to have an English-speaking meeting immediately." And you could tell she was very agitated. And I thought, oh, whew, that could have so easily been me. And I was so grateful again for the practice and total compassion for her, but you know what I mean. So, you know, but that was a great teaching. I just really saw how this practice can work to our benefit. And that's just one small example. But lots of things like that can happen throughout our days. And the more we practice, we're inclining our minds towards wisdom and away from these defilements that we're talking about. So there's a famous teaching in the suttas that I thought maybe I would read, because it's one of my favorite suttas. It's Majjhima Nikaya 19, for those of you interested in these kind of things, but you don't have to know that. And it's called Two Kinds of Thought. And he uses this word bhikkhus, and I came across a bhikkhu is just anyone who's trying sincerely to live these teachings. So it's not necessarily a monastic. So we could all consider ourselves bhikkhus here on retreat. So he says, he's at a certain park. There's the usual, thus have I heard. And then the Blessed One, the Buddha, is addressing some bhikkhus. He says, bhikkhus, before my enlightenment, while I was still only an unenlightened bodhisattva, it occurred to me, suppose that I divide my thoughts into two classes. Then I set on one side thoughts of sensual desire, thoughts of ill will, and thoughts of cruelty. And I set on the other side thoughts of renunciation, thoughts of non-ill will, and thoughts of non-cruelty. As I abided thus, diligent, ardent, and resolute, a thought of sensual desire arose in me. I understood thus, this thought of sensual desire has arisen in me. This leads to my own affliction, to others' affliction, and to the affliction of both. It obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from nibbana. When I considered this leads to my own affliction, it subsided in me. When he saw this leads to my own affliction, it started to subside. When I considered this leads to others' affliction, it subsided in me. When I considered this leads to the affliction of both, it subsided in me. When I considered this obstructs wisdom, causes difficulties, and leads away from nibbana, it subsided in me. Whenever a thought of sensual desire arose in me, I abandoned it, removed it, did away with it. So, another way of putting it is, he started to see, you know, see his thoughts kind of divided into, you know, wholesome versus unwholesome, or sort of those that led to greater well-being and those that led to harm or less woe, less, you know, the opposite of well-being. And then there's a key line that he says, bhikkhus, whatever a bhikkhu frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of his mind. Again, bhikkhus, whatever one frequently thinks and ponders upon, that will become the inclination of their mind, or our mind. I think that's one of the great lines in early Buddhist literature, that whatever we frequently think about, ponder upon, that's what we're cultivating. So I've heard one Tibetan teacher say, we're always practicing something. So either we're practicing anger, greed, you know, cruelty, whatever it is, or we're practicing these more wholesome, positive qualities, that whether it's mindfulness, loving kindness, the things we're... So that's the beauty of something like this retreat, where we're actually putting in serious time, cultivating these wholesome qualities and trying to kind of take some of the power out of these distracting defilements that we can often be plagued by. And as I was teaching a sutta study over the last year, I was just, this teaching comes up a lot. This is a big, somehow it hadn't struck me this way until kind of recently, just the way, in a way I'm starting to feel that this particular teaching is very pivotal in the Buddha's way of understanding the world and just a key teaching to really pay attention to. And so I've tried to really take it to heart as much as possible. So I got a little story for you that I think it's Jack Kornfield's version that I think it did come from. It's a loose adaptation of a story from the suttas, I think, but getting back to right effort, he says, effort in spiritual practice is not about a goal because we can't even measure it in our normal way. So it's more like the ocean. But then he has this story. The Buddha encountered a yogi in ancient India whose ascetic practice was to stand in one place on one leg. So the Buddha comes across this guy standing in one place on one leg. And the Buddha asked him, how long have you been standing like this? Many years. The Buddha asked, why do you do this? To burn off my past karma and purify myself, he said. Well, how much more karma do you have to burn up? I don't know exactly. Well, how much karma have you burned up so far? I don't know exactly. How long do you think it will take? I don't know exactly. Finally, the Buddha asked, what are you doing? The man began to question his actions. Ultimately, we are cultivating the energy that allows us to be present, mindful, and more fully alive. This is wise effort or energy. One thing that I love about the Dharma, the Buddhist teachings, is that they are often pointing us in very practical. It's very practical in many ways. It can apply in, you know, large or small moments. This is a pretty small thing, but I remember I used to be late. I used to have a little problem with time, and I would be late to things a lot. And I had arranged to meet with a Buddhist teacher who lived near me. He like would meet with people at his house. And so I was supposed to be meeting, but I got caught in traffic or something, and I'm contacting him saying, I'm going to be late, you know, sorry, getting all stressed about it. And he just wrote back, well, let's just meet at a later time. And that just seemed like I was just going to stress out about being late to the time that I was supposed to be there. It never even occurred to me to sort of reschedule or push it. He just had this ease of like, oh, well, let's just meet an hour later, no big deal. And it seems small, but these are the kinds of things where, delusion was at work in my mind, and he was just very clear. I was like, okay, we'll just meet later, not a problem. So that is a maybe not the most inspiring story of all time, but I don't know why I'm not able to think of a better one. But there's also, you know, one aspect of right effort is persistence. I really liked Vance's use of the tortoise and the hare analogy because the tortoise, there's a real persistence there. The tortoise is just going to keep going. And he knows he can only go so fast, but it's not stopping him from setting out on his journey and keeping going. And I was reading the biography of Ajahn Chah, who was a Thai forest master, that Jack Kornfield's teacher in Thailand and many other people's teacher. anyway, this biography had this interesting passage. It said, the Buddha, it says, the Buddha declared that all avoidable human suffering is caused by mental defilements, and that these defilements can be completely eliminated by a systematic education of body, speech, and mind. So we've been talking about that. Supreme among the virtuous qualities that, quote, burn up the defilements, he revealed, is forbearance, patient endurance or self-control, restraint and tolerance. And so then they go into this, it says, it is perhaps no coincidence then that the unwelcoming environment of Northeast Thailand nurtured a great flowering of Buddhist monasticism in the 20th century. The vast majority, this is where Ajahn Chah came from, the vast majority of monastics recognized in Thailand as enlightened masters over the past 100 years have come from this one region. In this jungle and forest area full of wild animals, malaria is rampant, the soil is impoverished and sandy, and the groundwater is salty. So it's kind of a rough place to live, but these folks have been eking out a living for who knows how long. And they, so the, it's just kind of built into the culture of that part of Thailand, this forbearance. And it's just a good pointing that we have to have forbearance in our own practice, or at least if we want to, it would be helpful if we do. That, you know, don't give up too easily kind of thing. We have to kind of stick with it for a while. It's not going to happen overnight, as they say. And this can just be inspiring. There's a Dalai Lama teaching, just says something about just don't give up. Whatever happens, don't give up. And sometimes we just need to remember that. I mean, this is not to be in a place of constant striving, but it's also to try to have that patient forbearance that's necessary for progress. Muhammad Ali once said, I hated every minute of training, but I said, don't quit, suffer now and live the rest of your life as a champion. So I don't know if that's right effort, but it sounds good. He also said, don't count the days, make the days count. I like that one. So hopefully you made your day count today. I should have said that this morning, obviously. There's also a great quote from Sylvia Borstein. She's a Buddhist teacher, teaches mostly in Spirit Rock on the West Coast, but she kind of has a homespun wisdom style of teaching a lot of the times, and apparently this came from her mother, but she uses it as kind of like a right effort to give herself a little extra energy. Her mother apparently would always say, you're not going to get to do today over. You're not going to get to do today over. So that can be useful too. In kind of the traditional Buddhist teachings, there's the contemplation of death, which sounds pretty ominous, but it can be a daily practice where we just really take in the fact that we don't know when we're going to die. We really don't know how long we have, but we have right now. And so we need to we can use that to motivate us to A, be more present now, because now is what we have to work with. There's the monk that I mentioned previously, Bhikkhu Anālayo, or Venerable Anālayo. He actually lives at Barry Center for Buddhist Studies nearby. That's where he's staying in recent times. And he really has taken this death contemplation to heart, to the point where he sleeps in a bed shaped like a coffin. And which is a pretty powerful... At first I thought, wow, that's kind of too much like a vampire or something. But as I continued to think about it, it's inspiring that that's the level of... It's kind of like those bumper stickers. I mean, he just really wants to have a constant reminder to keep him focused on what he feels is, you know, how he wants to really use his time. And certainly with the pandemic and everything, it's become, you know, it just feels like things are as precarious as ever, shall we say. As an aside, I once, my wife and I were in the very fortunate situation of shopping for a house, and we found this house that came with a giant stone Buddha head. I mean, basically, I was really tired of even looking at houses, and one day she said, well, oh, there's one other house we should look at. It's like Sunday afternoon. The last thing I wanted to do was look at another house. But she talked me into it, and we drove to some neighborhood that already I was like, I don't want to live here. And then we walk in, and I see this pretty big stone Buddha head out on this little balcony, and I thought, wait a minute, this is a nice house. And I started trying to see, like, it really did help me re-see the house in a more positive way. I guess I just took it as a sign. So anyway, we ended up, this is our house, and we have this beautiful stone Buddha head. And I was working at Spirit Rock at the time, so I told Jack Kornfield about this great stone Buddha head at our house, and he just looked at me. I thought he was going to be so much more enthusiastic. He said, Walt, apparently you need a lot of reminders. But he's right, I do. So I couldn't really argue with that. I can see it while I'm eating every meal. I guess I needed that. Of course, when you live with something like that, you actually kind of tune it out after a while, I'm afraid. No, but I still notice it. So I haven't really gone into right effort very diligently here. I mean, I just like these inspiring, pithy lines. In the Mahaparinibbana Sutta, which is about the end days of the Buddha, where he was his last days, it records that his last words were the following: "Now, monks, I declare to you, all conditioned things are of a nature to decay. Strive on with diligence." Or, "All things are impermanent, strive on with diligence." But that's, as far as we know, the last thing the Buddha told his followers. So I find that also quite inspiring. Joseph Goldstein says, "Right effort in meditation is both a science and an art. We have to know when to apply the different aspects of our energy or effort. Sometimes we need to sit back and allow things to unfold naturally. And sometimes we need to push ourselves a little harder to combat sloth and torpor or other difficulties in our practice." In the famous description the Buddha used was of the strings of a lute, that they had to be not too tight and not too loose. So there's no, you know, I like, you know, the idea that it's both a science and an art. We kind of have to keep working with it and find the right balance there. The Gil Fronsdale, one of my teachers, says, "Distinguishing mental actions that are skillful from those that are not is at the heart of right effort." But So as we work on being more mindful, I guess we see that the starting point is inevitably starting to see the defilements that are there. And then the goal is to work towards a mind free from defilements, free from greed, hatred, and delusion. So that gives us a sense of kind of where we're headed. But and there's a famous list of the four great endeavors of right effort from the discourses. The first great endeavor is to prevent or guard against the arising of unwholesome states. Number two, to abandon unwholesome states that have already arisen. Number three, to arouse or develop wholesome states that have not yet arisen. And fourth, to maintain and sustain wholesome states already arisen, and to perfect those wholesome states. So hopefully you could sort of see how we've been working on that throughout this retreat. But it's, you know, the work is not done. Vance had mentioned the five hindrances that come up a lot in practice. So probably you've experienced some or all of these just even in the last few days. The first one is around sensual desires. We tend to get really caught up with that one. We like sensual desire, pleasure, things that are pleasant. And then the second one is ill will or aversion, you know, things when we don't like what's happening, we want it to stop and go away, and that really bothers us. And the third one is what we talked about, sloth and torpor, sometimes called dullness and drowsiness. Then the fourth one, restlessness and worry. And then lastly, doubt. And I'm not going to go into all the different antidotes for all of them, but these are important, obstructions to our practice that we need to become familiar with as we continue, but we don't have to see them as some terrible thing we have to get rid of. It's more that we start to understand their nature and see where they take us and how they create suffering in our life. And then we naturally start to want to abandon them, to focus on them less. That to me is really, in a way, enlightenment, is seeing that these really don't serve me the way I thought they did. Sensual desire being one of them. And being somebody in recovery who can get kind of hooked on stuff pretty easily, I have been dealing with this my whole life. Not that long ago, I went to the doctor for a regular checkup, and they did some kind of blood test and came, I think it was a blood test, but anyway, they came back and said I was pre-diabetic. And I immediately thought about the things I was eating on a regular basis and drinking. It was like a lot of sweet tea, green, like I had this one brand of sweet tea that I didn't even think it was that sweet. And then I stopped drinking it for 6 months and then had one and I almost spit it out. It was so sweet. So I had just been without, I just really wasn't, you know, I was just reaching for the pleasurable beverage, the pleasurable cookie, whatever it was. And I just had no worry about, I wasn't thinking about health or things like that. So then once that happened, I realized I had to pay a lot, be more mindful of what I was taking in. Of course, when I was on retreat, I was eating really well, not eating that kind of stuff, but on my own, kind of stressed out at work, I would go grab something at the store for lunch, and it would be the sweet tea and a sandwich and a cookie. And so anyway, what I'm noticing is that this monitoring quality of mindfulness comes in handy constantly in life. And this understanding of, like you said, the two kinds of thought, that really with a practice we start tuning into that on a not only daily but moment to moment experience, where the more we can do it in a way, the more we actually benefit. That's a, you know, one example, but there's many. I mean, ill will is kind of an interesting word that we don't necessarily use a lot in common culture, but I've started to just notice if I have a thought of ill will, like if I'm sort of having a conflict with somebody, like usually my wife, and I start to sort of notice thoughts of ill will coming up, then that is now for me a red flag. It's like, this is not, I need to take this a little more seriously. I don't want to be having thoughts of ill will towards somebody I care about. But I didn't think of in those terms before I had this practice. So it's been really useful the more I practice, to just start working with these kind of things and seeing it more and more. And we end up avoiding a lot of, you know, my disagreements with my wife tend to last much less time than they might have. So, you know, and we're, one thing that I've always found sweet is that we're both good at apologizing kind of quickly after we have some kind of little snafu. So, yeah, but it's an ongoing practice for sure. And then Ajahn Suchito, a monk who is from England, he lives in a monastery in England, but he comes to the U.S. regularly. He's a wonderful teacher and very wise. He says, the key point is that wherever your attention gets established, then that's where your energy goes. In parentheses, programs of habit. And that energy and focus becomes your world. Whether it's meditation, music, or computer science, your heart adopts the concerns, values, and energy that go along with that. So is it worth giving yourself to? He says, you might want to ask, is this worth giving myself to? But I love that the key point is wherever your attention gets established, then that's where your energy goes. So again, just another way to think about how the practice works with the mindfulness. And cultivating mindfulness, then we can start to really pay attention to where our energy is going. What am I putting my energy into? Is it into being distracted all the time with, you know, the latest sports update or whatever? Okay, I do occasionally do that. Just, you know, looking for that balance too, that not that we can't enjoy lots of things. But, you know, another thing about Venerable Anālio, he talks about how, so he's seriously the most prolific author that I've ever seen, him and Stephen King maybe. But he comes out, somebody said he publishes books faster than I can read them. And it feels that way. I'm not, like, that doesn't even feel like an exaggeration. And he publishes a lot of scholarly papers too. The BCBS website has a list of them, and it just seems like it goes on for forever. And he attributes his ability. He says, people think I must have assistants cranking these things out for me. And he says, no, I really write them all myself. And he attributes his ability to do that, that he's simply not distracted. He said He has learned to work skillfully with the hindrances. So that is not a problem for him, and he can just focus. If he wants to write an article, he just sits down and writes it. I wish I could do that. So, you know, but, you know, he's probably not on social media, for example. But I just think that's inspiring, too, that if we set our mind to it, we can accomplish a lot. It just depends on, we have to decide, what do I value? Where do I want to place this kind of effort in my life? Where do I want my energy to go? And, I mean, the Buddha, what I like about the teachings of Buddhism is it's not moralistic. It's not, you should do this, you shouldn't do that. But it's more like, if you want to suffer less, you might try this. Or if you're happy suffering, go for it. But you're going to keep suffering and it's going to get worse. So, another great quote is Sayadaw Utejaniya said, either there is momentum on the wisdom side, or there will be momentum on the defilement side. So that's kind of ominous almost. If we're not cultivating wisdom, then he's sort of pointing that we're probably cultivating defilements in some way, or we're entertaining defilements. And again, check all of this out for yourself. You don't have to believe everything I'm up here reading or saying, but it kind of rings true. One thing about doubt, one of the five hindrances, is that we tend to believe our doubt. So when a doubt creeps in, the one thing we forget to do is doubt the doubt. Because often the doubt that we're talking about is when we doubt our own ability to do the practice, or we doubt that the practice is worth our time, or the doubt the teacher, or something that kind of keeps us from practicing with, you know, the kind of effort that we're talking about, the balanced, you know, persistent effort. So we just need to notice, the most important thing is if a doubt creeps in, notice, oh, doubt has arisen. And we can kind of see it in a different light when we can name it for what it really is. It's just a doubt. We don't have to get lost in, you know, believe the doubt and stop practicing just because of that, just because a doubt arose. So we can kind of take some of the air out of the tires of the doubt. And the antidote for ill will, incidentally, is the classic antidote is the metta, the loving kindness practice, sending the person metta. It's also another very helpful aspect of that is to think of the person's good qualities. So we might be kind of in a conflict with them, and we get blinded by what we're pissed off about, and we forget to remember their positive qualities. They may have done, last week, they may have done some really nice thing for us, but we've already forgotten because we're so busy focusing on what we're upset about. I was on in a training, like a two-year training, and we had regular retreats for that, and I was on one of those training retreats, and I'd had some kind of conflict with my now wife right before going on this training retreat, and so I was kind of agitated, and I was we were meditating in the hall, and I was thinking about how I was upset with her for whatever. I can honestly not remember what it was about now, and then I remembered, oh, I wouldn't be here if it weren't for her. She helped pay for me to be in this training because she generously offered some of the money I needed so I could do the training in the first place. And I'm sitting here, you know, having this wonderful opportunity, largely because she was so generous. How could I possibly be mad at her? And it was like the second I had that thought, it just completely fell away. It's like, so that was another great teaching, to see that and just start to apply that more regularly. So I soon we will be returning to our regularly scheduled lives with our, you know, jobs, families, friends, whatever it may be. And hopefully we will be able to take some of what we've cultivated here over this short but hopefully helpful retreat. And one definition that's, I think, a Chinese Buddhist teacher offered was, you know, what is enlightenment? An appropriate response. And I've always found that really useful. Is this, so before I act, to try to remember to ask, is this an appropriate response? Is this a skillful response? Because it also points to the fact that really, it's not like we're going to get enlightened and then just act perfectly for the rest of our lives. It's more like, are we enlightened in this moment to the point where we can have an appropriate response? And notice the word is response, not an appropriate reaction. Because part of it is we're changing our relationship with what's happening from, you know, being reactive to being responsive. And Ajahn Sumedho, another teacher, talks about how enlightenment is simply being a mature adult human being. I think that's kind of like that low bar. Maybe that's not a low bar. Maybe that's a really high bar. I'm not still, that's a koan. But it's an interesting way to look at it. So, having become a parent myself kind of late in life, it's kind of resonated more and more with me, because now I really am, I need to be the adult in the room. Occasionally my wife says she feels like she has two kids, but anyway, I don't really appreciate that comment when she says it. But I am working on being a mature human being. So one, my background is more in kind of literature, English major with a master's in creative writing. So not the most lucrative field, but I love writing, and as you probably noticed, I like to read poems. So I thought I would end with this poem by William Stafford that I once heard in a really touching, at the funeral of a guy that I had worked with, and his son read it, and it really touched me at the time, and I just think it's a really powerful poem. It's called "With Kit, Age 7, at the Beach." We would climb the highest dune, from there to gaze and come down. The ocean was performing. We contributed our climb. Waves leapfrogged and came straight out of the storm. What should our gaze mean? Kit waited for me to decide. Standing on such a hill, what would you tell your child? That was an absolute vista. Those waves raced far and cold. How far could you swim, Daddy, in such a storm? As far as was needed, I said. And as I talked, I swam. So let's just sit for a moment. How far could you swim, Daddy, in such a storm? As far as was needed, I said, and as I talked, I swam. So thanks for your kind attention, and I guess now we have walking and the final sit of the day at 9 o'clock.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.